Okay, so we're at page 6 of 14, and last week we were right in the middle of looking at some of these different views that there are showing the relationship, trying to describe the relationship between science and religion. Last week we talked about the conflict view and the independence view, and this week we're looking at the dialogue view, and then we're going to look at the integration view. And then after that, after the break, we're going to look at intelligent design as a topic, as a thought process, as a approach. And then the next several weeks, we're going to look at specific topics that fall under intelligent design. So this week, it's kind of more introductory. But before we get into that, we're going to finish up this section on the dialogue view and the integration view. And the dialogue view is the historical one. And I say that because up until about the Enlightenment, Christianity and science had more of a relationship than they do now. So Christianity had a strong influence in establishing the right worldview for science. And it laid the foundation. We kind of talked about that a little last week. And the methodologies are not distinct. And when I say methodologies, I just mean the method of doing theology and the method of doing science have a lot of give and take, ebb and flow to them. And so, without going into the details, one could study how quantum physics has developed over the last 75, 90, 100 years, and also look at theology in the early church time and recognize a similar method of development from its initial early embryo stage, if you will, for these two different realms, quantum physics and theology. And one also can see, when looking at Christology, which is a sub-branch of theology, that Christology was very... it caused a lot of problems in the early church. A lot of theology was based on Christology, which is basically who and what is Jesus Christ? How do we understand him? And how do we make sense of him saying that he's the Son of God with the fact that he was a human? And so there's a little bit of... there's some problems that introduces in theology. And so how do we resolve this problem with this guy who says he's God, but then he's fully man, obviously? And so a lot of heresies came because of theologians trying to answer the problem of what is Jesus Christ. And so people who taught heresies were excommunicated out of the church at that time. It was kind of very, very harsh. And they were called names sometimes by other theologians. And it got really messy. But over 400 years, 500 years, things started to funnel down and settle in, and we arrived at some sort of Christology that wasn't self-contradictory, even though it was still mysterious, that you had Jesus Christ as 100% man and 100% God. And some tried to say that he had two personalities, or some tried to say that he was 100% human, but only had a spirit of God kind of sent to him, like as if you get baptized in the Holy Spirit. That's when the Spirit of God came on Jesus Christ. And so he wasn't necessarily born man, the Logos incarnating man, but he was just imparted with a special spirit of God. And that's how he called himself Son of God. So these sorts of heresies developed or were formulated in this early embryonic Christian theology stage. And what we see in quantum physics is something mysterious, where we know these things are happening in a certain way at the quantum level. We know that the electrons are behaving this way, and we try to do experiments on them, but we're not fully certain on what is happening at that level. We don't want to be self-contradicting when we describe it, but we do want to be truthful. So similar to Christology, we can say things that are true of the natures of Christ, and we can say things that are true of quarks and their behavior, but we may not have complete knowledge of both fields, and so there's mystery in both. Now, mystery doesn't mean a paradox, or mystery doesn't mean contradiction. It means more paradox. It means just something we don't fully understand, but we almost could wrestle with the positive truth claims that we can make about it that correspond with reality, and we could state those, and we can be confident in them, but we don't necessarily have all the answers. And so all that is to say that there is mystery and knowledge in both Christology and quantum physics, and that development one could see, and one could say that the development of both is similar, and at 2,000 years apart. So I prepared a 15-page outline on the similarities between quantum physics and Christology, but I'm not giving it to you because I want to move right into intelligent design, where we're going to cover that tonight. So I just wanted to tell you a little bit about that, and I could kind of draw some diagrams on the board showing the heresies, but I'm just trying to summarize that mystery is okay in both fields, science and theology, and both are very accepted. You know, we accept our doctrines of Christ, and we accept the results of quantum physics, and we do so without having complete and full knowledge. So again, methodologies are not distinct. There's some similarities there. And scientists have, now I'm speaking loosely here, but scientists with an S at the end have faith, and theologians have reason. Now that may sound strange, because we usually think the opposite. But scientists must trust their instruments. They must trust uniformity of nature. And they must trust other scientists' testimony. And theologians must think critically. Both sides rely on personal judgment and authority. And so when we talk about faith, like we've mentioned before, we talk about it as an active trust based on things we are certain of or have a level of certainty in. And so in the same way, scientists don't just do a few experiments and know everything there is to know about science in their respective fields. They start off by reading perhaps some books or going to take some classes or looking at some journal articles or looking at some lab reports, and they start understanding what other scientists did who came before them. And so a lot of times that's what theologians do too. Theologians read and read and read and read, and they listen to other speakers and they do their own research and so forth. So in the same way, just as scientists think critically, theologians must think critically. And both sides rely on personal judgment and authority. Now, the historical relationship between science and religion has for the most part been one of dialogue and interaction. But this does not necessarily mean integration. We're going to get to integration later. But I'm just speaking of the past for now, this historical relationship. There's been a lot of dialogue and interaction. Now, one could say, when talking about the Enlightenment, that prior to the Enlightenment, we had, and again, I'm just speaking broadly, say this K represents knowledge when someone is considering how we learn as a human race, this overarching kind of idea of knowledge. So this is prior to the Enlightenment. You had a lot of philosophy as a foundation for knowledge, so it was very prominent in the academic spheres, and you had science, and you had language, and you had religion, and X and Y and Z, you know, and so forth. So philosophy had a prominent place during the Enlightenment and prior to it. And then once the scientific revolution, industrial revolution came into play, we had, based on the Enlightenment, we had, I'll draw in another color, more of this feeling and fat and feeling and subjectivity running out of space, and fact divided and objectivity. And so what happened with Kant and other Enlightenment philosophers is that they took this and they created that. And again, I'm speaking broadly, not precisely, but this in general is what took place. And we've talked about rationalism and empiricism, and I'm writing small now, and these two forms of how we know things here by just using reason and thought process, and we know things here by doing experiment or experience, empiricism, and these seem to just inform fact and objectivity, which were grouped together. And it, what took place was this divide between what many historians call the upper story and lower story. And so because of Immanuel Kant and other philosophers, you have an upper story of knowledge that was separated from the lower story. And what was in the lower story, in more things that are here on the earth, that we can know with certainty because we interact with them and we experience them daily, is fact and objectivity. That's what we call it. We call our knowledge fact and objectivity. So from these things, we get, from this lower story reality, we get what could be thought of as knowledge. This stuff, facts and objectivity, produces knowledge. Whereas, so that relates to this, whereas now feeling and subjectivity produces not knowledge. So non-knowledge, and kind of philosophy speak. But that's kind of the idea, is that because of the Enlightenment and because of what took place philosophically speaking, you had a huge shift from this type of thinking and this type of method in acquiring knowledge to something that was very segmented and divided in society. Now this is what we are living in now, but it's morphed into something we can call postmodernism, and some may even consider our time post-Christian, post-postmodern, things like that. But this is kind of where it all broke down, or was modified. And again, Immanuel Kant was instrumental in doing that. And Immanuel Kant, he used he called this the noumenal realm, and this the phenomenal realm. And so again, these were separated. He thought that God exists in this area up here. God is up here, and everything else is here. Okay, and that's our whole knowledge base. Now, God is something that we may exist, but we can't know he exists. We have to remain agnostic about God. God is a being that we have no knowledge of. We have no knowledge of because he's based on feelings and subjectivity. He's based on the person, who you are, how you think, how you were indoctrinated as a kid, those sorts of things. But, and so he remains up here. He may exist, but we don't know. And so this is kind of the fact-feeling divide that took place a few hundred years ago. And again, this is very different than this view. And so this view was more of the historical one. And so I say historical, I mean kind of prior to the Enlightenment. And this is the type of realm that Isaac Newton was living in during his time. Okay, so I had a timeline showing different events in history from the Greeks or Egyptians to, say, now, but I didn't bring it because I thought it was just a little too much. And but I do just want to say that this dialogue and interaction really goes back to the Egyptians and Greeks, who considered science and religion to be interrelated parts of philosophy. So when Aristotle and Plato wrote and spoke, they did so on the basis that philosophy was kind of this overarching discipline that spread into all fields and was kind of integrated or at least interacted with the other realms of knowledge, the other fields of academia. So famous physicists in history that were Christians were Galileo, Isaac Newton, Michael Faraday, James Clerk Maxwell, Lord Kelvin, George Lemaître, I'm not sure if I'm saying his name right, but he's a Catholic priest who first proposed what became known as the Big Bang theory, Max Planck, father of quantum theory of physics, and George Mendel, father of genetics. And say it. Oh, thank you. Gregor?
G-R-E-G-O-R.
Thank you. Okay, thank you. So you can see here on this list that there's been some prominent scientists who were also Christian. And again, I'm just bringing this up because I'm trying to show there's a historical relationship between science-minded people and Christianity. And that's really all I'm trying to say there, is that one doesn't have to be a great scientist and remain agnostic or atheist. One could be a Christian as well. Now, currently, 51% of scientists who are members of the American Association for the Advancement of Science profess belief in God, which is about 33% of them, or a higher power, which is 18%. You add those two up and you get 51%. Now, this was a poll that was done, you can see here in this chart, which basically just explains that 51% number. If you average, or there at the top row, it says all scientists, 33 and 18. So those who believe in God are kind of on the left-hand side of this chart. It's colored, but you can't see the colors here. And then the second kind of color there to the right is identified as percentage of people who don't believe in God but do believe in a universal spirit or higher power. So, you could take a look at this for a moment. It's kind of interesting. Okay. So if you poll other scientists, you may get the same sort of poll. But this was just a poll that was taken on those who are in the AAAS, and this is the largest, most general scientific society, and represents scientists from all different fields. So it's a good cross-section, if you will, of the scientific community. All right, so that's kind of the survey. Now, 51% of current scientists profess belief in God. And if you turn the page, this 51% is a very consistent survey when considering a survey done in 1996 by the historian of science Edward Larson at University of Georgia, and a survey done actually in 1914 from a psychologist, James Luba. Now, what that is just trying to express is that over the last, say, 100 years, the belief in God amongst scientists hasn't changed much. You're still around 50%. And that says nothing other than you could be a good scientist, and there are many scientists who believe in God. It may not be God of the Bible, but it may mean a God who's a higher power of some sort. Any questions on that before we move into the integration view? All right. Pretty straightforward. So it's that whole idea, this dialogue view, is just to say that there's interaction and a relationship between these fields of knowledge. Now, integration view takes that same idea or that same perspective and builds on it. And so in part A, this is just a little nutshell. If you read this, it's kind of a summary. But the integration view is this view. This view develops a unified worldview where God's action in nature is plausible, meaning that God can act in nature and science can understand that action. Science and theology can enlighten and inform each other as we seek to know ultimate truth. Science is the tool we use to explore God's creation. The world He made is a book of nature for us to investigate like the Word of God. Both of these views, Book of Nature and Word of God, will never be in conflict because God is the author of both, but our interpretation of each can sometimes be off. And so this view is more of a stronger position than the dialogue view, and it's basically saying that if I read this book in English and read this same book in Spanish, they're going to say the same thing. It's just two different ways of looking at the same reality, science and English. Science and, say, religion. Same reality, two different books describing it similarly. Now, integration is common in other academic fields. So we see psychology and anthropology being similar and relating to each other and very integrated. History and science are integrated when looking at how archaeology and geology and things like that develop. These fields have different aspects to it that you could say are integrated. One field may add knowledge that gives further insight into the other. As a result, understanding in psychology is improved according to better data in genetics. So psychiatry informs psychology, psychology informs psychiatry, that sort of thing. So integration is common in academic spheres. We'll skip a little here. Go to part C on the next page. Now, what if one field reveals a difference with another field? So suppose you have geology saying that the age of the Earth is, say, 200 million years old. Let's just pick a random number. And then you have astronomy saying that the age of the universe is only, say, 5 million years old. What does one do? Obviously, those two pictures are conflicting. Well, in terms of science and Christianity, what does one do when science seems to conflict with Christianity or Christianity seems to conflict with science? Well, the Bible scholar may need to review and reinvestigate his position if scientific evidence points to the contrary. So the Bible scholar has a responsibility to be true to reality. He cannot just go and read the Bible and say, screw science, I don't care. He's got a responsibility to understand science. He's got a responsibility to recognize the results of science as being somewhat trustworthy, unless proved otherwise. He needs to be willing and ready to sharpen his pencil and think critically and not stop thinking until he figures it out. Now, most Christians are wannabe Bible scholars. We are kind of people that try to do that on our own time. And so the same applies for Christians. Christians have that same responsibility to research and prepare themselves for the results of science. Now, it doesn't mean he has to revise his position, but he needs to investigate until answers are found. The scientist may need to review and reinvestigate his position if biblical evidence points to the contrary. Now, as an example, I'll share with you the recent finding of Sodom by archaeologist Stephen Collins. Many in the last few hundred years of archaeology have thought that Sodom was at the bottom of the Sea of the Dead Sea, kind of more towards Jordan and Egypt, down there at the bottom. And many have thought that because of certain interpretations in the Torah. And when they investigate, everyone seems to have come up with the same opinion, that Sodom and Gomorrah were at the bottom of the Dead Sea, or at near the southern side. Stephen Collins came along a few years ago, and he started looking at these texts a little differently. And what he was able to gather was that Sodom and Gomorrah were most likely at the top, the north side of the Dead Sea. So he convinced a bunch of rich guys to fund his expedition and go dig up a bunch of stuff up at the north side. And lo and behold, he's found amazingly convincing evidence that Sodom and Gomorrah are up there. And he's actually discovered dust particles that represent some of the fiery chemicals that would have been in the air during that time where God was said to have destroyed Sodom and Gomorrah. And he also found bones around the site that were positioned in a way on the ground where it seemed as if the body was exploding or falling in some sort of manner, and hundreds of these bones in these positions and orientations, as if an explosion came down and people were kind of scattered and blown away by the explosion. Now, he is fully convinced that this is Sodom and Gomorrah, and many others are as well. So for, I don't know, 100 years worth of archaeology, you have a new location, completely different than before, where science, a scientist, and a whole bunch of other scientists have to revise their position based on where Sodom is now thought to be. So this, again, all I'm trying to say here is that the Bible can inform of reality, and the scientist may need to restructure and reshape his position based on the Bible. The differences allow us to refine our simple or initial interpretations of each, the book of nature and the Bible, to a more sophisticated and nuanced level. So we get to refine our positions. We get to re-examine our positions, whether you're a scientist or a Bible scholar. And you can use the one and the other to help solidify your position or change it and come up with something more accurate. We can do this without jumping to conclusions that the book of nature or the Bible has to be thrown out. And we could do this before we state that the book of nature and the Bible are conflicting. So before we go and read something, or we do some science experiment or investigate something, we say, ah, these things are conflicting. Let's throw one out. Let's throw out science, if you're a Bible-thumping fundamentalist. Or let's throw out the Bible, if you're someone who likes to disown religion, or that sort of thing. We don't have to go to those immediate conclusions right away. If the Creator God exists, as the Christian doctrine teaches, the book of nature and the Bible will tell the same truth, as they both inform us of the same reality. If the Bible is true, if God who is who he says he is, if God is the creator of the world, then shouldn't our science experiments reveal to us what he's done? If God is not the creator of the world, then those two things will conflict, because the Bible says he's the one that created it, he's the one that established it. But if science tells us differently, then we have a conflict. So the question is, do we have a conflict? And I'm suggesting in this class that no, we don't. I'm suggesting either the dialogue view or the integration view. My preference is the integration view. And so the integration view says that both speak of the same truth because it's the same reality, and both will report the same data. Certain important scientists have held to the integration view. Many current scientists who fall within the intelligent design camp hold this view. That's pretty obvious. Other current scientists who are Christians hold this view, such as John Polkinghorne. He's a big-time scientist in the field of quantum mechanics. He says, "I'm a very passionate believer in the unity of knowledge. There is one world of reality, one world of our experience that we're seeking to describe." Many famous scientists of the past seem to have held this view, or the dialogue view. Isaac Newton, you can see there. Max Planck, you can see there. And then Albert Einstein. Now this one is more interesting because he's not a Christian. But he held to the integration view. Let's see what he said. Give me a second. Einstein said, "Religion and science go together, as I've said before. Science without religion is lame, and religion without science is blind. They are interdependent and have a common goal, the search for truth. Hence, it is absurd for religion to proscribe Galileo or Darwin or other scientists. And it is equally absurd when scientists say that there is no God. The real scientist has faith, which does not mean that he must subscribe to a creed. Without religion, there is no charity. The soul given to each of us is moved by the same living spirit that moves the universe. I want to know God's thoughts. The rest are details." So that's Einstein. And again, he held to this view, these things are interdependent. I'm using the word integration. Judeo-Christian tradition promotes belief in a God who created the knowable universe. And Jews, Christians, and Muslims too believe in a creator who made an orderly, rational, understandable universe and gave us the permission and the ability to investigate it and utilize it, thereby legitimizing science and technology. And here are some scriptures that I'd like you to read. Just briefly, you could go over it. But I want to point out Jeremiah 33. "I established my covenant with day and night, and the ordinances, or natural laws, you could say, of heaven and earth." Heaven, at the time, meaning the cosmos. So I invite you just to read through these other ones. And last thing I'd like to say on this topic is that the integration view presents the most realistic and favorable approach of all the four different views described. Now, this little discussion that we've had about the different views to see how best to view science and religion was not extremely thorough, and it was very brief. And I recognize that, but the point of it was more to just show that although many in our culture today view science as conflicting with religion, the first view that we talked about, it doesn't have to be that way. We can have other views that are more accurate in understanding how these two fields relate to each other. Any questions on that? Quiet. Okay, let's go through this page here, and we'll take a break. To discuss the issues of science and religion, it is important for Christians and non-Christians to understand both correctly. Now, the reason why that's very important is because we need to have civility in our conversations. And we need to be able to dialogue with each other without picking up each other and throwing each other off a bridge. We need to have a spirit of truthful seeking, a spirit of folks who want to know each other better and why each other thinks the way we think, because that's how it's got to start. It's got to start with being willing to dialogue with each other and hold each other highly, in high regard. It has to start with person to person. And the only way we can continue the discussion is if we start there, where we value the other person. And then how we approach the conversation is as follows. Approach the dialogue with humility and grace, for now we see through the glass darkly. And 2 Corinthians talks about, I think it's 2 Corinthians talks about, then we will see more fully. So we don't have all the answers right now, but eventually we will. We want to understand the spectrum of positions and arguments on all sides. We want to realize that most people are on a journey, and on a journey still, figuring out where they stand. We're kind of all on our way somewhere, and our thought processes will change over time. So we want to recognize that about the other party. We want to recognize that these issues are not fundamental to your faith or your salvation. So, in other words, if you don't believe that intelligent design, for instance, is a true, accurate reflection of reality, that doesn't really matter in terms of your salvation. Learn to live with the tension. There's going to be some things unresolved, definitely in this class. We're not going to be able to cover everything. And so we have to be able to say it's okay to not have it all figured out. And you don't have to have all the right answers immediately. And don't let arguments and disagreements upset you. So if you're having these conversations on the street, we need to be able to approach it with humility and then say, you know, at the end of this conversation, maybe nothing gets accomplished, but we at least are trying. We're at least trying to think. We need to take St. Augustine's advice from 1700 years ago. He says, in essentials, unity; in non-essentials, liberty; in all things, charity. So again, charity, love. It's got to start there. Read and educate yourself. And there are a ton of books on the relationship between science and religion. Rather than get overwhelmed, there's a few right here that I recommend. Some of them are back there. That really talk about the relationship between science and religion better. And so that's just a real brief way to think about this. And it's just to kind of whet your appetite and how best to approach the discussion, approach the relationship, and recognize that there's a whole 2,500-year Western history of these two fields interacting with each other. And the last 200 years don't have to be all there is to know about that relationship. So keep that in mind. Any questions? Okay. Let's take a break, and I'll see you in about 5 minutes, and we'll start intelligent design. What that means is, if intelligent design is true, if intelligent design is true, it doesn't mean we get the God of Christianity. It doesn't mean we get Yahweh God. It doesn't mean that we get anything remotely close to God. For instance, if you start with the universe to the left, and get to intelligent design at the top right, and then all these other guys further to the right, you can arrive at agnosticism, a pantheist worldview, a panentheist worldview, Buddhist, Christian, Muslim, Jew. You can arrive at aliens. You can arrive at panspermia. And I'll explain those. So you could keep this in front of you, maybe take it out, and we're going to just kind of think about it on the next several pages. One could reason that intelligence is some being which is unknowable, as in agnosticism. One could say that There's just some intelligent being out there, but we can never know what or who or what, anything about it, as in agnosticism. Also, one could reason that intelligence is matter or in matter, which is or are God or gods, as in pantheism. That is, the universe itself is God, or is composed of individual gods, or gods are within matter, but are not the matter. Thus, designers are, or within, the matter of the universe. So essentially, if you hold that to intelligent design, and you say that, okay, well, what sort of being is this? You could say that, well, it's a bunch of gods, or maybe that gods, or that matter is God. You could say that matter is in the, gods are in the matter, or that matter itself is gods. And that is driving the design of the universe, biochemically, astrophysically, and so forth. You can arrive at that conclusion if intelligent design is the case. Three, some higher power, as in the Eastern or New Age religions. It's not a personal being, but it's just some higher power. You can arrive at that conclusion if intelligent design is the case. You can arrive at the conclusion God, as in Islam, Judaism, or Christianity, is the source of the intelligence. Or you can arrive at the conclusion that an alien or an alien community in a parallel universe, or this universe, is the source of that intelligence. In other words, that an alien from this universe or another parallel universe came to Earth somehow and implanted design, and that's how intelligent design got here. Or this idea of panspermia, which I think originated from Francis Crick, who is someone who discovered DNA. And I'm not certain on that, but I think he proposed this idea that microbes from space landed here on meteors and asteroids. So that's the idea that there's just life all throughout space scattered uniformly in these forms of microbes. And some of these microbes were in a asteroid contained in some sort of inner compartment or portions of the rock, and they're just flying through space because planets explode and things are happening and all over in space, and somehow they got trapped into an asteroid and they landed here, and that's how we've got the origination of life. So this idea has been coined panspermia. So all of this is to say that ID only shows that some form of intelligence was involved, such that one could speculate what that intelligence is from one of a variety of possible options. So basically, you can get to intelligence in these forms. You don't have to get the God of Christianity. That's not the only option when you are talking about intelligent design. Now, that may come as a surprise to some of us. Interestingly, strictly speaking, if intelligent design is in fact not the correct way to understand reality, this doesn't mean that gods or God cannot exist. So let's look back at our little chart here. Suppose you're at universe and you get to naturally produced, that is, the universe is naturally produced, you can arrive at the possible options of atheism, agnosticism, gods, or God. And then, let's just hold there for a second. So, part four is just saying that gods or God can still exist even if intelligent design is not true and you just have a naturally produced universe. So back to part four. Granted that gods or God may not have caused it all, so our understanding of gods or God would have to be changed. But a naturally produced universe doesn't necessitate that gods or God are impossible, as spiritual beings may have generated from the universe as consciousness did. Now, Paul Davies, he's a cosmologist, he holds this idea that the universe is essentially what created us. We are products of the universe. We are children of the universe, as he puts it. We're stardust. We're children of stardust, I think, is what he says. And so what you could say is that, well, suppose that you do have a naturally produced universe. You could also not only have consciousness arise out of that, like Paul Davies says occurred, but you could also have gods arising out of that. There's no stopping gods from arising out of this universe if consciousness did. Now, that sounds strange to some of us, I'm sure. But there's nothing that rules that out with the idea of a naturally produced universe. Let's see. Part 5. Another way to consider this is if the neo-Darwinist theory of evolution is in fact the best way to understand reality, it does not follow that already existing gods or a god didn't design the natural process. So, if you go back to your chart here, and you go down to the bottom right, suppose you're in a naturally produced universe, and you have gods and gods that are existing somehow, in some way, and we'll have to, again, modify our view of what these things are, it doesn't follow that they could not have produced the intelligent design process. They could have created an intelligent design process to create this natural universe, this naturally produced universe. Again, item 5, second sentence, one could hold that gods or a god, as in the Christian position known as theistic evolution, in some way designed the natural process to produce higher orders of life. It could have been designed to produce even higher orders or only much lower orders. And note that we'll discuss the theistic evolution position at the end of the class. So all I'm saying here is that if you hold to the fact that gods exist and they live in this naturally produced universe and they produced, say, the ID process in biochemistry or in the cosmos, you could also say, well, they could have produced a process or could have created a process that would have produced humans that are 10 times better than we are. Or they could have produced a process that creates humans that are 10 times worse than we are. So in other words, our humanity is contingent upon gods or gods, God or gods. And so it doesn't follow, again, that just because you have a naturally produced process that you can't have intelligent design. You can have an intelligent design in the universe or in the cell, for instance, even with a naturally produced universe. Item 6. Additionally, if neo-Darwinism is right, one could still say that organisms on Earth were intelligently designed by gods or God, who designed such an intelligent natural process. So overall, by way of disclaimer, ID doesn't produce much by way of implications, and with neo-Darwinism, it doesn't rule out much by way of implication. So everything you see here on this chart on page 1, to the right of intelligently designed and naturally produced, is just the implication of these positions or these scientific finds. It's just an implication. So what intelligent design does, if you look at this chart, is it just talks about the universe and intelligently, whether it's intelligently designed or it's naturally produced. So that's kind of what's here at the bottom of page 3. Just these two options. And intelligent design doesn't say anything about implications, which are to the right. And naturally produced universe, that view, or that scientific find, doesn't say anything about implications. Okay? So when considering ID, item 8, the possible implications are usually sources of contention and more heat rather than light, meaning there's more argument rather than knowledge gained in those conversations. But as we have seen, the implication of these two alternatives are broad and unrevealing. what is of scientific concern are the two alternatives and not the implications. So again, ID on its own doesn't imply much. It could be used to build a broad inductive case for pantheism. So in this class, I could create a big argument for pantheism using intelligent design. I'm not going to, but I could. It supports a pantheistic worldview. You may not have thought that when you came tonight. But ID is included in this overall class argument and structure because it does fit in my argument as the third premise, so formulated to build a broad inductive case for science supporting Christianity. And at this point, it is not clear if the ID that is argued here is the source of the natural process of evolution or not. And so what I'm saying is that I'm not necessarily explaining in this class whether or not ID is the source of the natural process of evolution. I'm not even going to touch that conversation in this class. I'm going to present theistic evolution and some other views later on. I'm not going to necessarily argue for either one. I'm going to let you judge on that. But this, again, is later on when we talk about the biblically based views that are harmonious with Scripture. You could judge with your own mind which ones are harmonious with Scripture and which ones aren't, and which ones are true to the scientific data as we look at biochemical stuff and evolution stuff in the next few weeks. But again, the point of this disclaimer is just to say that ID in it by itself does not argue for the Christian God, and a naturally produced universe does not rule out ID. You can still have ID. And a last disclaimer, ID doesn't have to be perfect for one to infer ID. So, in other words, if someone says, well, the panda's thumb or the eye or something is an imperfect design, it does not rule out God, the Christian God, as the designer. Because ID is not saying that things have to be perfect. All it is saying is there design? Is there intelligence? That's all it's saying. It's just trying to answer those questions. And we're going to talk about now ID a little bit more. Is there any questions, though, on this first disclaimer? Yes?
On the prior page, where you go to the diversity of the culture, redesign, or answer produced, how would you define the natural produced? In other words, that precludes any. For example, above there in 6, you talk about how, you know, Darwin allowed for natural processes being used by some intelligence. So, how would you define, does neo-Darwinism kind of bring those two together? Those two blocks there, possibly?
So the question is, if I'm talking about a naturally produced universe and I'm talking about neo-Darwinism, how does intelligent design fit into that picture?
Right, because wouldn't they be possibly integrating the two?
Kind of, yeah. So, like, the ID process could have been produced by gods, let's say. Okay, let's say there's 20 gods up there and they designed or created this process of evolution. And in that process that they created, they set in motion at the initial stage all the features and activity that would need to take place at certain time intervals to create ID at the end. So in that sense, it was a natural process, naturally produced universe. And we could be talking about the cosmos too. We could be talking about asteroids and the expansion rate of the universe or different things like that. These 20 gods set that into motion initially. Set into motion everything that was necessary for this particular outcome that we see today. So in that sense, it's naturally produced, but it was intelligently designed. The intelligence was provided at the initial stage, the back end. I'm not arguing for that position.
No, but
I'm offering that as a suggestion that view that a universe could have been naturally produced does not rule out intelligent design. You could have still gods at the initial stage that created that natural process.
And given that scenario, the whole, what would you say, event or experience would fall under intelligent design, natural, not production.
Yeah, okay, so how I'm organizing this chart. I get your point. That it could be this idea.
How are those two things both different?
Hold on, let me answer this. I know where you're going there. But no, I think what I'm trying to say with this diagram is that the stuff on the right is implications, is the implications of a scientific finds of a naturally produced universe, that's what we find with science, or an intelligently designed universe, which is what we find in science. So we have these two options. What are the implications that we can draw from that? Okay? And that's what this diagram is trying to do. Now, what I'm saying is that what you're saying is that intelligent design should be on the left-hand side of this diagram. Yeah, that's true. You could think of it that way. You can get a naturally produced universe from intelligent design. So that's another way to think about this. Yes. I mean, we're talking about some far-fetched stuff right here, so perhaps someone could think of something different, you know, even more far-fetched, or maybe, but probably not. But I know what you're saying there. It's a different way to structure this this flow of thought. That's one structure, what you just said. This was the other one that I'm trying to present with implications on the right. Now, Scott, you were asking, say it again.
Well, you just, if I understand correctly, I don't know what that is. So, okay, we just described two different, we've got a completely and total random type of non-theistic way of the universe forming as far as evolution goes. And then we have a theistic deity that's using evolution to come to an endpoint that is preconceived, and so we have intelligent design via the route of evolution.
Yeah.
How would those two appear different? Well, either way I look at those, whatever pushes that ball in motion, the end result and the entire result and everything in between does not look any different, right?
Yeah.
Okay,
correct.
That's my question.
Yes.
How would you identify the two?
Okay, so we're going to get into this discussion of how does one determine whether something is naturally produced or intelligently designed. That we're going to get into
that's
shortly.
Okay.
Yeah.
That's
yep. That's a good question. All right. So. Okay.
Oh, I know. You flip it over and read the tag, right? It says.
Yeah. Bought $5.99. Yeah. Okay, page 4, the teleological argument. Now, this term teleological comes from the Greek word telos, purpose, which just means purpose. This is the idea that the effects we see are due to an intended purpose. And what this is an inference to the best explanation argument. Now, Darwin used inference to the best explanation. He asked, how can I best explain the observations? He inferred that the best explanation was natural selection based on random variations and common descent. Now, we're not going to go into that right now, but I'm just pointing out that Darwin used this thought process called inference to the best explanation. 4, inference to the best explanation is used all of the time in life, academia, and especially science. This is no new concept for educational spheres. And note that this type of reasoning is used by auto mechanics, judges, and Bible interpreters. So when someone is drawing an inference, as we say, they are saying that I have all this data from all these observations, what best explains that data? What theory best explains this current set of information I have? So auto mechanic, he's diagnosing a car, trying to discern what the problem is, and his computer tells him it's the mass airflow sensor. He is taking some measurements of the exhaust. He is looking at the mass airflow sensor, and it's twisted and broken. And so he's drawing an inference to the best explanation of what's causing the car to perform poorly. It's the mass airflow sensor. Judges, Bible interpreters, everybody uses this kind of reasoning process. And this inference is known as abductive reasoning or abduction in philosophy. So it's a type of reasoning, and it's very common, but it has a name. And this is a type of inference that assigns special status or truth and best to explanatory considerations. So when we're trying to explain something, we're trying to say, what is the best explanation? What is the most true explanation of these observations? Given evidence E and candidate explanations H1 to HN of E evidence, infer the truth that HI, let's say H5, best explains E. So all this is to say is that if I have some chunk of evidence, what conclusions could I draw? What explanations could I generate that help me understand this body of evidence? And then I need to choose the best of those explanations. In other words, HI is the inference to the best explanation. It's one hypothesis. Well, it's one explanation that is the best, and I choose that one. So I need to generate a bunch to choose one of them. So abductive reasoning is the same as inductive, except that it goes beyond induction by making an implicit or explicit appeal to explanatory considerations. It could be understood this way, as developed by Charles Sanders Peirce, a philosopher. Developed this stuff about 1950, and basically he just spells it out like this. The surprising fact C is observed. Let's call it C, the speaker over there, Roland. But if A were true, C would be expected. If this building was a church or a classroom, I would expect to find speakers. Hence, there is reason to suspect that A is true, that this building is a classroom or a church. In other words, A is inferred as the best explanation of certain evidence C. Now, I'm drawing a specific conclusion about this building, but I could say that this building is a place where voices or music is to be projected. I could be more general than saying church or classroom. And that best explains C, the speaker, the evidence. This is reasoning by abduction. And Peirce thought that all of science and trial law is abductive reasoning rather than just inductive. So there's a little bit more to it. Inductive only goes so far. And Charles Darwin employed this type of reasoning in his theory of natural selection. Now, we could read this. Science begins by assembling a series of observations, then goes on to ask what framework of interpretation makes most sense of what is observed. How good is the fit between theory and observation? That's what science is trying to do. The Stanford Encyclopedia of Philosophy, this is an obviously non-Christian source, it's highly respected in academia, it states that most philosophers agree that this type of inference is frequently employed in some form or other, both in everyday and in scientific reasoning. Dictionary of Philosophy, type of inference yielding an explanatory hypothesis. So that's just how it defines abductive reasoning. And note that with all abductive reasoning, you cannot prove which is the best explanation. It takes discernment within a scientific community, for instance, where you have to decide which you believe to be right on the basis of evidence available and realize the evidence isn't conclusive enough to prove either option. So this type of reasoning takes judgment. And again, this type of reasoning is used all over the place, especially science. It does not depend on us trying to best explain or trying to explain the designer or designers, but we can just say that the designer or designers is the best explanation of the facts. So again, we don't have to figure out the implications of intelligent design. We don't have to go there if intelligent design is the case. We can just say it's intelligently designed and we stop there. It does not depend on us trying to explain the designers. Oh, I just read that, sorry. Number five. The logic of the design inference moves from a marker of intelligence, specified complexity, for instance, to an intelligence as causal agent responsible for that marker. So it's just trying to say that when you find and detect in nature intelligent design, you can make an inference from there saying that there's some sort of a causal agent for that phenomena that you just observed. Item six, it's not just that phenomena are highly or even extremely improbable complexity, but it is the fact that the event conforms to an independent pattern specific, which can be thought of as specified complexity. And we're going to talk about specified complexity more in the next few weeks. But this is just the idea that when you have something that's improbable, we'll call it complexity. And when you have an independent pattern, we'll call that specific. And when you have those two things at the same time, you have what has been termed specified complexity. And we'll talk about that. And that term originated in the 1970s by information theorist and scientist Leslie Orgel. It did not originate with the so-called intelligent design movement of recent times. Seven, it appears that the most plausible explanation of the evidence is that the organism or universe was designed. Now, I'm just saying this is what people say. I haven't proved anything. We can infer this logically and rationally. Thus, it is a reasonable inference. So this is how the thought process works, is that you could say that the most plausible explanation of this specific evidence is that the organism or the universe is designed. That's how it kind of goes. And we can infer this logically and rationally, and this is a reasonable inference. Now, in a nutshell, ID theory infers that intelligent action was involved at some points with origins. Certain features of the universe and living things are best explained by an intelligent cause. Life exists as a result of purposeful action of an intelligent designer. Now, this is, in a nutshell, how you could describe ID theory. So far, are there any questions? We're just scratching the surface, just getting our feet wet. Yes, sir? Yeah. Yeah, right. If you are arguing deductively, then that conclusion you draw from a deductive logical thought process is necessary. It is absolute. That's deductive. Induction or abduction is a little bit less absolute. It's a lot less, actually. You can only have a certain level of certainty with inductive and abductive reasoning. If your level of certainty is, if you're 75% certain that this theory best explains the data, then you're 75% certain. That's all it says. Is that your, how much data or how much evidence do you need to see for your certainty meter to grow? And that's kind of how this is thought of.
And over time, if there was additional data, and that brought down your 75% certainty to something less, that might not meet your criteria for holding that.
Correct. Correct. In the previous class, we talked about what level of certainty do I have to hold to something beyond probable doubt or beyond reasonable doubt, like in trial law. So that is usually thought of as 90% certain or higher. If you're going to convict, if you're on a jury and you're going to convict someone, to a sentence or to guilt or not guilty, then you need to be above 90%. And then there's different levels below that, probable cause, the other legal terms. I don't have them right now, but yes, thank you. Yeah. Yes, a preponderance of evidence in a civil case can convict somebody, not criminal, though. Criminal, you have to be beyond reasonable doubt. Yeah. So abduction and induction is how we normally think about everything. We typically don't use deductive logic when we go about our lives. And no one really does in academia, because it's all really based on understanding what's really happening and drawing conclusions from that, which is what induction and abduction does. Other questions? Okay. We'll go through this last bit here. Actually, this may be a good place to stop when looking at the time. Okay, I'll just say this last part. We'll go to part D. When compared to the other theories that attempt to explain the data, the design inference is preferred as 1, it has the most explanatory power of all the competing theories, and 2, it has the most explanatory scope of all the competing theories. Other theories are rejected on their own merits. So when we have, say, 5 theories to describe some chunk of evidence, I have to decide which theory best explains the data. And quickly, it seems like it would just be as simple as saying that I have 1, 2, 3, 4, 5 down to n theories that best explain the data. And these could be all sorts of random conclusions that I generate from the evidence. Now, all abductive reasoning is doing is saying, this one is the best. I can call this one the best. And I'm going to then say that this is the view I hold, because it explains the most, and it has the most power in its explanation. It's compelling in its explanation, and it's the broadest in scope. So that's what this is trying to say. The best explanation would be the one that has the most explanatory power and most explanatory scope. So it doesn't leave anything out in terms of what it covers as a theory. It accounts for all of the data, not just some of the data, so it has the widest scope, and it has the most explanatory power. It explains with the most compelling argument, with the most thrust, and it's like, yes, that's it. Intuitively, you basically can say, yeah, that's it. You're right. Yes, sir.
So are you saying that your other candidate theories there that aren't the best, are you saying that they have other things missing? Like you included them in your list, but yeah. Oh, I can't explain this piece of data or whatever.
Yeah, yes. Okay. So like if you go back to H1 stuff on page 5. So given evidence E, at the top here, we'll say given evidence E, say I'm observing what's that northern lights thing where the sky gets, yes, and it's all colorful and green and beautiful. I'm explaining that, so that's my evidence. I'm seeing green, it happens at certain times of year when the cosmos is like this and the atmosphere is like that, whatever it is. I'm experiencing this phenomena, I'm observing it, I take data readings on the light, the photons, the energy, so forth, for like 10 years, and I get all this evidence and data, and I'm trying to explain what are those northern lights? What is that stuff? Is it a bunch of Greek gods? Athena, Zeus, that sort of thing? Are they just having fun up there, throwing a party? Is it some natural phenomena, some electromagnetic nuclear activity? What is it? And then I'm developing these H theories, H1, H2, H3, H4, and so forth. And I'm saying that, it's this one. This one best explains it. And so that's the idea. It's an inference to the best explanation. There are several explanations. This one's the best. It's very simple. Now, intelligent design is usually thought of as an argument from analogy. An argument from analogy. And we're not doing that. And we're going to talk about that next time. But traditionally, that's what it's been thought of as. For instance, my watch, I could say, has all these features. It's got a battery. It's got all sorts of things happening here. Plastic. It's arranged really well. It seems to be ordered. And it's doing something that has meaning to me. I read it, and there's meaning there. And it seems like it was designed for a purpose because, I could just look at it. Intuitively, I am drawn to that conclusion. Okay, that's different than abductive reasoning. This is reasoning by analogy, that this is like other things that I know in the world that are designed for a purpose, like the table. There's chairs and around it. There's legs on it. They fold. People could sit under it. It seems like it's at the right level, so a chair would sit nicely under it. And I can describe it and say, intuitively, this has obviously been designed, and my watch has similar features like that. And I can say, by analogy, I can infer that my watch is designed. That inference is different than this inference. This is inference to the best explanation. This is inference by analogy. We're not making that inference. Traditionally, that is what was done. But that's not what we're doing. Yes, sir? Yeah, like I mentioned, Darwin used this. I mean, really, all science uses induction and abduction, both. I mean, it's just the way, most of the time, people don't sit there and talk about abduction or induction when they're doing science. And neither do we do that in our daily lives. But it's just how we do things. But I'm just trying to explain what it is that's really happening with intelligent design. We're only doing this. We're not doing the argument from analogy. The argument from analogy is a way to talk about design, and some people incorporate it, but I'm not doing that in this class. Yes, sir. Yeah.
What I want to know now is what mechanism do you have to keep your explanation from? Like, so you're saying that you need an explanation that explains all the data. What keeps you from overreaching? Like, what keeps it to be the minimal explanation required? Because, I mean, you could, I mean, without getting absurd, I don't want to say, point out anything absurd, but I could just say a wizard did it. And that explains all the evidence. Mm-hmm. The wizard has infinite powers and so on.
Yeah.
What mechanism do you have to keep explanations from overreaching?
That's a great question. 500 years ago, William of Ockham developed what has been called Ockham's razor, which is what I think you're getting at. And Ockham's razor is just this idea that the best explanation of something is the one that is the briefest, it has brevity, it's simplest. Anything that could be explained simply and quickly is the best, and it's the most accurate. Philosophers say, Occam's razor is this idea that you do not multiply entities unnecessarily, meaning that you don't just add a bunch of ideas to make a conglomerate theory when you could strip away all those ideas and just get this core idea, and that explains it just fine, or the most simplest. It's the most simplest explanation. So Occam's razor is incorporated oftentimes in philosophy and other fields of academia to understand what is the most accurate explanation, because it's just a way to detect what's the best. And some would say the best explanation is the simplest one, like William of Ockham tried to do. So to your question, how do you keep these from being so crazy once you get down and generate, umpteen...
Yeah, well, it's hard to tell it's crazy, right?
Yeah.
That's why I'm wondering, is there any methodology there?
Yeah, so Yeah, I would say the best explanation is not ad hoc. Ad hoc is something that's just ridiculous. And that is part of the criteria. I gave you two pieces of criteria. One with the most explanatory power and most scope. But the ad hoc criteria is one that says, this view is not ridiculous, or this explanation cannot be ridiculous too. So you need to apply that criteria as well. And there's actually like 10 of these criterions that you would apply to figure this out, to arrive at the best explanation. You have to apply criteria.
There are more.
I gave you two. There are probably 10 that most philosophers would use to go through the thought process. Yeah, so, right. So let's say that you have 10 and you're trying to figure out, and say 3 is the ID, and we say that that's the best explanation of all the explanations, and we would use that criteria to get to that. Yeah, it's a funnel, if you will. Yeah, it does, because the best theory will explain the data accurately. It's not just a theory that sounds good or a theory that makes us feel good. It's the theory that corresponds with reality. That's a good theory. It's not a random theory. So a theory is a good theory if it's not ad hoc. It has the most explanatory power and scope of the data. The proposition corresponds with the data, and so someone could say then that proposition is true. It is right. It ought to be inferred. Okay? All right, so let's end it there. And 2 weeks from now, we'll pick up the rest of this outline, and we'll get into a quick criticism that comes up on intelligent design. At this point, people just say, wait, hold on a second, and they propose this criticism, and we'll address that, and then we'll actually start getting into science stuff after that. So we'll be looking at hard science stuff. All right? Okay. Dear Lord Jesus, thank you for this time, and thank you for helping me get through this. I'm very tired and had a long week. And I appreciate your energy. And I pray that you give us all strength in the next couple weeks to get through what we're going through, and help us as we need you dearly. In Jesus' name, amen.